Well, good evening, everyone. Hope you're having a good week. I'm going to get into our class tonight as we continue in Exodus, talking about the plagues. Now, before we do so, though, let's go ahead and begin with a prayer. Father in heaven, thank you so much for choosing us from before the foundation of the world to be your people in Christ and to be inheritors of all of the spiritual blessings available in him. We are grateful for the word that you have preserved for us so that we can learn from it. We can grow in our faith and knowledge of who you are, and that we can please you in all that we do as we strive to do your will here on earth. Forgive us when we fail to do that, and help us to be more like Jesus. We pray all these things in his name. Amen. All right, so let's talk about the chapter summaries real fast here. Remember chapter one summary? All right, new Pharaoh. Secondly, y'all can just yell them out. That's fine. All right, Moses is born. Good. Third one? All right, good. Burning bush. Fourth? Aaron joins. Very good. What about the fifth?
Increased labor.
Yeah, increased labor. Excellent. All right, and the sixth? What happens when the labor's increase and the Israelites turn on Moses?
He loses his courage.
Yeah, he loses his courage. Okay, good. And then, starting in chapter 7, we have the plagues. Before I click this, does anybody remember the mnemonic that I gave y'all about the plagues? Did anybody find... I mean, if you found it helpful, I don't know. But anybody remember that? The mnemonic to remember all the plagues? Or never?
Forget.
All right, forget what?
God's.
All right, God's fierce punishment because he loathes defiant foes. All right, that's going to help because chapter 7 is the never part, the Nile to blood. And then chapter 8, you have three plagues. Forget, or frogs, gods, gnats, flies, fierce, okay? And then 9 is pestilence, boils, hail, punishment because he loathes defiant, a locust in darkness. And then foes is the firstborn, dies in 11, okay? And then we're going to talk in chapter 12 about the Passover. That's what we're going to learn about, Lord willing, tonight as we continue on. Okay, very good. Now let me just quickly review the purposes we went over of the 10 plagues, just to get that big picture look again in our minds. First of all, the plagues answered Pharaoh's question back in chapter 5, who is the Lord that I should obey him? You're about to find out, buddy. This is the Lord that you should obey, the one of the 10 plagues. Secondly, to judge the Egyptians and all their gods. Now, I actually want to make an addition to this. I should have said this. I didn't really think about it. It's really a judgment against all the gods of the world. Because think about Egypt. They are the most powerful nation on the earth. So what does that mean about their gods? Yeah, their gods. In the ancient mindset, ancient people would look and say, well, their gods are the most powerful on the earth. So what happens when Yahweh just walks in and just stomps them into the ground like they're nothing? Well, it means... Yeah, it means Yahweh is more powerful than even the most powerful gods on the earth, at least in their minds. So it's a judgment really of all the gods. It's to show God's power to reverse creation in judgment. He is the creator God who can use judgment and all the, or excuse me, who can use creation and all the elements as he pleases. And finally, to recreate his own people. And we'll see that a little bit more as we continue tonight. But that's just a big picture purpose of the plagues. Let's actually start in Exodus chapter 9. In Exodus 9, verse 13. Here, we see an intensification, or at least the threat of intensification of these plagues. Beginning in verse 13, then the Lord said to Moses, rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you and your servants and your people so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. For if by now I had put forth my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, you would have then been cut off from the earth. But indeed, for this reason I have allowed you to remain in order to show you my power, in order to proclaim my name through all the earth. Still, you exalt yourself against my people by not letting them go. Now again, I think when the Lord says, from this time on, I'll send all my plagues on you, the point is not, well, I'm going to send all 10 of them on you right now at once. It's not even, I'm going to send all 4 of these on you at once, at the same time, the 4 remaining plagues. I think the point is intensification, all right? These last four plagues. If Pharaoh thought the first six were bad, these final four are going to be horrendous. Right? And he's really going to unleash his power for Pharaoh and all the world to see in these final four plagues. So let's talk about those. Beginning in verse 18, down through the end of the chapter, you have plague number seven, which is hail. Let's read verse 22 through 26. Now the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, that hail may fall on all the land of Egypt, on man and on beast, and on every plant of the field throughout the land of Egypt. Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire ran down to the earth, and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very severe, such as had not been in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. The hail struck all that was in the field through all the land of Egypt, both man and beast. The hail also struck every plant of the field and shattered every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the sons of Israel were, there was no hail. Was it normal for the Egyptians to experience that kind of precipitation? No, all right, not even. What if it was just rain? Would that be normal for them to experience that kind of? No, even if it was just rain, that was weird. Because Egypt was, of course, surrounded by desert, and in Waldron's book, he mentioned they only get about 8 inches of rain per year. It's not much at all. Okay, but this would have been a monsoon. Later, we actually learned there was rain involved, as well as hail. Later in this chapter, he'll say that in verse 34. This was so serious because it wasn't just rain. It was hail that started to destroy their crops. It started to just shatter their trees. And you could just see it just knocking the fruit off the trees, knocking all the leaves off the trees. It's hurting animals. Okay, it's hurting men and women. In fact, God actually told them to do something about this. Remember, this is actually the first plague. He gives them a way out. But apparently, not everybody did. Okay. Only those who feared the word of the Lord, up in verse 20, actually put their stuff inside. Okay? In fact, this was so serious, Pharaoh reacts in a very interesting way. Look at verse 27. Then Pharaoh sent for Moses and Aaron and said to them, I have sinned this time. The Lord is the righteous one, and I and my people are the wicked ones. Y'all think this was genuine? No, especially after, you know, that sermon on Sunday that you heard about his heart. I think this is just one of those examples of shallow pseudo-repentance. What does he really want?
He wants everything to
be normal. Yeah, I'm tired of this hail. I'm tired of Egypt being destroyed. It's not, I want to be right with your God because I love him or because I respect him or because I want to be one of his people. I just want to be right with your God, so he'll leave me alone. So stop sending all these terrible things into my life. And of course, it's short-lived, because later in the chapter it says he hardened his heart, and he still refuses to let the people go. Okay, so you see God, he originates the plagues from water, from the Nile, and then he uses the dust of the earth, and now he's using the air. Okay, all the elements of creation belong to Yahweh. And this would have been, of course, a direct indictment against their sky goddess, Nut. Okay? And notice that the magicians are nowhere to be found, probably still nursing their wounds from those boils. And Yahweh is just wreaking havoc again on Egypt with this hail. Any comments or questions on this plague of hail?
Brian?
Yes?
I was just going to say, we've said, you know, this is God showing the world who he is. But in that, he's also showing them, it doesn't matter who you are. If you do what I tell you to do, I will love you and you'll be safe.
Okay, so good.
The Egyptians, it doesn't matter that you're the Egyptians. If you do what I tell you to do, I love you.
Okay, yeah, good point. God actually extends.
Could you repeat that again?
Yeah, sure. So her point is that God actually gives the Egyptians a chance to obey him. So he's saying you too can be saved from the hail if you'll just obey him. So she's saying it doesn't matter who you are. God just expects you to fear him and to trust him. And if they would have listened to him, they would have put all their stuff inside, and they would have been okay, at least their persons and their animals. Obviously, their trees and plants and stuff would have still gone. But can you just picture how it is over the Israelites? You have hail and lightning and everything falling everywhere, and then I don't know. Is it just like a dome, you know, this invisible force field, you know, over Goshen? They're not. They don't have any hail landing on them. I mean, that would have been amazing to well, see that.
What about when he called for Moses and Aaron? They had to go from Goshen to Pharaoh's palace.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that could.
Did they have an umbrella?
Yeah. Did they have a hail umbrella on the way over to? I don't know. Was it like the reverse of the cartoon?
Yes.
You know how the rain cloud follows you in the cartoon. Well, maybe it's the no hail. You know, followed Moses and Aaron as they walked. That's a good. God has the power to do that. So.
Have you ever seen what hail can do?
Not personally, no.
Yeah. Well, I've not been through it for hail storms.
Is that right? Okay.
And if you have car day lots with all these new cars on them,
oof, painful.
They're all not worth hardly anything if you get hail hit.
And they didn't have Allstate back then, right? No insurance. You're in trouble.
Not then.
You leave your car outside in Egypt, it's
or,
getting destroyed.
Or crops. Lots of crops.
Absolutely.
Will get killed in the United States. If you have hail.
Okay, yeah, great point. Great point. And they were so dependent on their crops. And that's why the next plague is so serious, too. He sends these locusts, the eighth plague in chapter 10, verses 1 through 20. Let's listen to just verses 1 and 2. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may perform these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians, and how I perform my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." You know, in the ancient world, if you sent your army out in battle against another army and your army lost, the mindset would be, well, their gods are just more powerful than ours. You know, we fought, we kind of gave it a valiant effort, but apparently, you know, their gods are just more powerful. But here, the Egyptians aren't even fighting. I mean, they can't do anything. They're not giving it their all. They're not giving their best to try to defeat God. Yeah, I mean, they're just sitting there, like sitting ducks, essentially. They can
do
absolutely nothing against him. And ironically, the Israelites aren't fighting either. It's just Yahweh fighting for them. And eventually, it's going to get to the point where the Israelites don't even leave Egypt from a war or a battle. They just walk out. And the Egyptians actually roll the red carpet out for them eventually and say, just get out. You know, we don't even want you in the land anymore.
They give them all sorts of things.
Exactly.
To take with them.
Exactly. We're going to see that later. Okay? So this is why God says he's making a mockery of them. It's not just why I've defeated them in battle. It's I've embarrassed them. And the Egyptians would have been very, very embarrassed about all of this, okay? And God wants his people to never forget this. So he tells them, look, in future generations, you tell your son who I am. You tell your grandson who I am. Never forget what's happening here. Hang on one second, Steve. And this is a hint, of course, why he's going to institute the Passover feast later in chapter 12. Look in verse 5. I will come back to you, Steve. I just want to get through this section real quick. Verse 5. They, the locusts, shall cover the surface of the land so that no one will be able to see the land. They will also eat the rest of what has escaped, what is left to you from the hail, and they will eat every tree which sprouts for you out of the field. It's hard for us to imagine how serious this was because, you know, if we have locusts, we can send out some insecticide spray trucks. You know, we still have Publix and we can go pick up our food, it'll be fine, it's all indoors and stuff. But it wasn't like that for them. Locusts were a horrible, horrible, devastating force. Even the normal amount of locusts, which there could be huge, huge swarms, even not being a plague from God, there could just be millions of them just swarm the land, and they're so hard to deal with. And Pharaoh's servants know if these locusts come, it's going to be horrendous. And so they plead with Pharaoh in verse 7, they say, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? Yet, even still, Pharaoh refuses to let them go. In fact, he starts negotiating. You know, he says, I'll let you go, but you need to leave your children behind. Well, obviously that's pretty clever, right? Because He knows they're going to come back to get their children. He's trying to make sure that they come back, that they don't leave permanently. And Moses says, sorry, that's just not going to work. All right. And so we see the rest of this plague played out in verse 13. Let's read down through verse 17. I want to make some very specific points about this. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. They were very numerous. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was darkened. And they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant in the field through all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron. He said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now therefore, please forgive my sin only this once and make supplication to the Lord your God that he would only remove this death from me. And then verse 19. So the Lord shifted the wind to a very strong west wind, which took up the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not one locust was left in all the territory of Egypt. I want you to see that this plague is actually a foreshadowing of the next two plagues and a foreshadowing of the ultimate fate of the Egyptians. One, you see that these locusts caused darkness over the land, and we're going to see in the next plague that's what God does. He's going to cause darkness. He also, very ironic, Pharaoh begs God to remove this death from him. He doesn't really know what death is yet until the 10th plague. Then he's going to really want God to remove death. And then when you read later in Exodus 14, when God parts the Red Sea, it says he brings up a strong east wind all night to part the Red Sea. And then he does the same thing here with the locusts. He uses this east wind to bring the locusts, and then when he gets rid of them, he drives the locusts into the Red Sea until not one of them was left. And that same language is used in chapter 14, where God essentially drives the Red Sea down on the Egyptians until not one of them was left. Not one of them remained. It's chapter 14, verse 28. He says that. So, really, this is the beginning of the end for the Egyptians. And that's going to be highlighted even more in the next plague. Steve, I told you I'd get back to you. Sorry it took so long.
I realize it involves a degree of speculation, but how long between the plagues?
That's a good point. Some of them tell you. You know, some of them will say, you know, like the Nile to blood lasted for 7 days. You know, the darkness in the next section is going to last for 3 days. But some question, well, did they overlap? You know, okay, maybe the Nile was blood for 7 days, but then did another plague start before that one was finished? That's a good question. We don't know all the details about that, but some of it does give the time frame. I think it's the flies where it says, it never says that it ends. So some people think the flies just kind of kept being in Egypt. I don't know about that. I don't know if that's fair, but it doesn't actually say that, okay, God stopped this one. I think it's either the flies or the gnats on that. Good question. Any other questions about the locust plague, Chloe? Oh.
Not about that.
Forget it then. No, go ahead.
Going back to like the gods, like Yahweh being showing all the other gods up,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that kind of show all the other countries or like the areas that Yahweh was not to be messed with?
Yeah.
And like, I guess part of me is like, if that were the case and the Israelites didn't, like, because Pharaoh's biggest argument was that the Israelites are too big and they'll attack us.
Mm-hmm.
But once the plagues hit and the surrounding areas didn't attack and the Israelites from within didn't attack, mm-hmm. I think that would have been a big warning, like a big sign saying, you know, like, we're not going to hurt you, so stop treating us so bad. I don't know, I feel like Pharaoh might not have seen it because his heart was so hardened,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like all the Egyptians couldn't have been on Pharaoh's bandwagon.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I don't think they were. In fact, I think some of the Egyptians leave Egypt with the Israelites, is what we're going to see in chapter 12.
But they longed to look to him to stop, do what he says is what the people were saying.
Yeah, definitely. It seemed like the servants were kind of catching on to, Yahweh is not to be messed with. What are you doing, Pharaoh? Just listen to him. Just let the people go. What's your problem? He didn't get it. Scott?
I venture to say there was a food shortage in Egypt for a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolute devastation of their land. We read this and we memorize these plagues as kids, and maybe, you know, we come up with these neat little mnemonics and stuff, and it's neat to memorize. But if you lived through that, it would be horrendous. It would just be awful. We can't even really imagine, because we're just so blessed in this country with food and, you know, ease of food, that when you had to work in an agricultural society, you had to work hard for your food, and all your animals that you use for work are being killed, and all of your plants and trees and crops are being taken away. I mean, this was just a nightmare. It really was a nightmare. And it all could have been avoided if they'd have just obeyed him and let his people go, right? They brought it on themselves. Great comments and thoughts. Let's keep going with the plague of darkness in chapter 10. Notice verses 21 through 23. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. Love that verse. Remember, the plagues are a reversal of creation. And not only has God turned the animals against them, and he's taken away their health, and he's taken away the plants and the vegetation that he gave them for food, now he's going to take away their light. And this is significant, because the most powerful of all the Egyptian gods was the sun god Ra. And it's easy to see, of course, why primitive people would worship the sun. The sun is so powerful. It lights up the whole sky and gives off the tremendous heat. Yet, how does Genesis describe the sun? What does Genesis 1 call the sun? Is it a god? It's just a greater light. And God put it there. It's the greater light to rule the day, and God put the lesser light to rule the night, the moon. And God can just snuff it out whenever he wants, because it's not a god. It's just the greater light that God created. And it's in his power and in his control. Ra has no power at all, because Ra is not real. And Pharaoh is still negotiating, and now he's saying, okay, you can go. Leave your animals here. Well, that's not going to work, because the whole reason for leaving is to worship Jehovah in the wilderness, and they're going to need their animals for worship. So again, Pharaoh is still trying to kind of make a power play. You can go, but on my terms, so that I can still maintain some level of dignity. Moses says, no, you know, that's not going to work for us. We're going to need to take everything. And he even says that. He says, actually, nothing of our belongings needs to be left in the land. We're just going to go completely.
Not a hoof.
Yeah, not a hoof.
Left
there you go. Not a hoof shall be left behind. Yep. And so Pharaoh is just enraged. Verse 28. Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again. From the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, you are right. I shall never see your face again.
Did they not meet with him after that then?
Yeah, that's a good question. And people are wondering about chapter 11, because obviously he's going to announce this firstborn plague to him. We're not exactly sure when that happened. You know, was it maybe, some people picture it like, Pharaoh says this and Moses says, all right, you're right, you're never going to see my face again. And then he goes, one more thing before I go. And then he tells him about the firstborn plague in chapter 11. That's a possibility of how that went down. Yeah. Steve?
If Pharaoh had not hardened his heart, would the Israelites have gone out and come back?
Another great question, Steve. I don't know. I think the whole point is God didn't ask Pharaoh to let them go completely. He starts with a smaller request. And the point is, his heart is so hard, he won't even grant that smaller request. So, you know, some have tried to make way too much about, like, well, Yahweh's trying to trick him, and once they leave for the 3-day journey, they're never going to come back. I don't think that's the point. I think it's just to expose the hardness of his heart. Yahweh's saying, I don't even need to ask him a big thing. I mean, he's already asking a big thing, but the bigger thing would be let them go completely and never come back. But even the small thing, Pharaoh won't won't have any of it. His heart is so hard. Aaron?
I really have a question. In the second half of verse 23, it says, "But all the people of Israel had lied where they lived." I don't know why I haven't noticed this before now, but any thoughts on where the light source was for Israel?
The Lord. I mean, think about it. There was light before there was sun in Genesis. You know, God said, "Let there be light," long before he created the sun. So, you know, he's the light source. So he could provide that from anywhere. So, yeah, that's a good question, though. But it's such a awesome passage, you know, and great application where Jesus says in the New Testament, "You are the light of the world." You know, we have God's light in us, even in a world of darkness. Makes a great sermon. You know, preach that someday after you forgot that I made that point. Anna.
It says, "Have light in their dwellings."
Yeah.
So it's not light.
Yeah, maybe it's not outside their dwellings, but it's just inside. Yeah. Good observation. Yeah, it's interesting to think about what that would look like if you actually were there. It's just very powerful, and it's a good exercise, right? Rather than just read over this and say, "Oh, yeah, they had light." Think about it. What would it have looked like? What would it have been like to live there? It's just amazing. Good thoughts. Good comments. We get to the 10th. Whoops, I meant to click that a long time ago. We get to the 10th plague, and that's the death of the firstborn. Okay, and he says this here in 11:1-10. And notice verses 1 and 2, "The Lord said to Moses, 'One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold.'" And then Moses goes on to explain the plague. But interestingly, this plague doesn't actually happen in chapter 11. It's just the announcement of the plague. The plague doesn't happen. Turn to chapter 12 and verse 29. Let's read about that. 29-32. "Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, 'Arise up. Get out from among thy people, both you and the sons of Israel. Go and worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also.'" This plague worked exactly like God said it would. He said, "There's only going to be one more, and then he's going to let you go." He knew it would be the final straw for Pharaoh. And again, this was another judgment against Ra, because Pharaoh was viewed as the incarnation of Ra, and so was Pharaoh's firstborn son. He was also the incarnation of Ra. He was also viewed as divine. And so God takes this divine firstborn from Pharaoh, and there's nothing that adult, grown-up Pharaoh can do about it. Interesting, we have an inscription on what's called the Dream Stela by Thutmose IV around 1400 BC, which is about 50 years or so after the Exodus. And it describes how the Pharaoh after the one we're reading about here, okay, this Pharaoh is Amenhotep II, assuming we're going with that date, and I think that date makes sense. Amenhotep II. This stela was written by the Pharaoh that followed him. Okay? And in the stela, he has a dream under a sphinx, and the gods reveal to him the surprising news that he will be the next king. Now, interestingly, if you are the firstborn son of the king, why would you need surprising news from the gods that you're going to be king? You wouldn't be surprised at all, because you're the firstborn and it's your right ever since birth. You would kind of have that understanding. So the question would be, why would Amenhotep II, why would this Pharaoh's next person on the throne, a successor, why would he need this great revelation from the gods that he's going to be king? Well, because he's not the firstborn. Because this Pharaoh's firstborn died in this plague. Interesting. Interesting. Lining that up with archaeology. And all this was a promise fulfilled to Pharaoh. Because remember, from chapter 4, God told Moses to tell Pharaoh, you let go of my firstborn son, Israel, or I'm going to kill your firstborn son. And also, not only was that a judgment against Ra, it's really a judgment against Pharaoh, who tried to kill God's firstborn son in chapter 1 by throwing the Israelites, first by trying to kill them in childbirth, and then by throwing them into the Nile. Pharaoh had threatened God's firstborn son, and now this is judgment for that action. Let me make this note. From the author's perspective and the pattern of this book so far, it seems strange that Moses would put the threat of the plague in chapter 11, but then not actually see the plague happen until the middle of chapter 12. Usually it's the threat of the plague and then the plague happens. But not so this way. And I think that's because Moses is trying to show us that the Passover in chapter 12 is intertwined and intimately connected with this final plague. It's not just, hey, the death of the firstborn, and then there's a random instructions about a feast later. It's, here's the threat of the plague, here's the Passover instructions, because this is all about this plague, and then here's the actual plague carried out. And so it's just a way, narratively, for an author to intertwine. Mark does that a lot in his gospel with sandwich accounts. He starts something, and he takes a pause, puts something in the middle, and then he finishes it, because all three are interrelated. Same thing Moses is doing here. And we're going to see that chapters 11, 12, and the first part of 13 are all related to the 10th plague of the death of the firstborn. And I'm going to have to pick up the pace a little bit here. So let's talk about chapter 12 and the Passover. In verses 1 through 13, you have the introduction to the Passover meal. Aaron, verse 1, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Remember, when God uses that creation reversal to judge his enemies, he also uses it to recreate his people. This is a new Genesis. This is a new beginning, okay, for his people. And he gives them this new calendar year. At least it's on the religious calendar. It's different from the civil calendar. But it's a new religious calendar to keep track of their feast days and important times of worship. And of course, it marks the birth of a new nation and coming out of Egypt. Now, we also learn what was required in order for them to become a new nation was death. Bloodshed. Death not only of the Egyptian firstborn, but death of this lamb, this Passover lamb. Okay? And so he gives them instructions that on the 14th of this month, each household is to take the blood of a perfect unblemished lamb or goat and kill it at twilight. It should probably be around 6 p.m. Then they take some of the blood and put it on the lintel above the door. And they take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts. And then they're to eat the lamb by roasting it with fire. And they're to eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. You know, they're not to eat it raw, probably because a lot of pagans did that and worshiped to their gods. So they're not to eat it raw. They're also not to boil it, because in order to boil it, you have to put it in a pot. And in order to put it in a pot, you have to probably break its bones. And God says this has to be unblemished, an unbroken sacrifice. Okay? And they eat it with leavened bread because they were in a hurry to leave Egypt after this 10th plague. As soon as the 10th plague strikes, they're out of there. And so they don't have time to wait for bread to rise, so they use unleavened bread. And probably the bitter herbs would have reminded them of the bitterness of slavery that they were under. And it's called the Passover because when God sent the angel destroyer to destroy the firstborn in Egypt, he passed over all the houses with the blood on the doorposts, okay, and spared the Israelites by that blood. It was the blood of this animal that saved them. In verses 14 through 28, this is to be preserved as a memorial. Okay, he doesn't say just do this once. He says do it every year. You're to commemorate this Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was 7 days after the Passover. Right, this was celebrating, you know, continued celebration of God's salvation in Egypt. And the point of all this was so that when they celebrate the Passover, their children would ask, hey, what are we doing? Why are we celebrating this? And they could say, because of what Yahweh did for us all that time ago back in Egypt. It would remind them to be grateful to God. It would also remind them who they are and where they came from. And it would set this great context for the relationship that they have and their obedience. And then in verses 43 through 51, there are some stipulations for foreigners. Because there were some foreigners that came out of Egypt with the Israelites. And God says, foreigners are allowed to partake of the Passover, but only if what? Yeah, only if they are circumcised. And I think the implication is they submit to living like the Israelites. And finally, in verses 33 through 42, which I'm only going to cover to 36, they leave Egypt. And all of God's promises are fulfilled to Abraham. Because remember, back in Genesis 15, he said, your people will be strangers in a foreign land, and they will be enslaved for 400 years, but I will judge that nation who oppressed them, and you will come out of there with many possessions. It's exactly what happens. Verse 33, the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we will all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened with their kneading bowls, bound it up in cloth and clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Everything God said, as always, comes true. And here you have these all-powerful Egyptian masters, and at this point they're begging these slaves to leave. And even asking them, can we help you on your way? Can we help you on your way out? And gave them all their possessions. We only have 3 minutes left, and I wanted to kind of make this more participatory, but I don't think I'll be able to with the 3 minutes. But think about the parallels with the Passover in the New Testament. I'm sure your brains have been thinking about that. I found 10 of them. Just think about these with me. All the things God knew beforehand, 1,500 years before Jesus came and the plan for the church. Paul calls Christ our Passover in 1 Corinthians 5:7, because it is his blood that spares us from death. Secondly, Christ was crucified on the Passover, on that very day, and he was unblemished. You remember they went to go break his bones like the other two, but what happened? They found out he was dead already. They didn't need to break his bones. So Jesus was literally, his bones were unbroken. And of course, he was unblemished in character because he was perfectly innocent. He was the perfect Passover lamb for us. For us to be saved, God's firstborn had to die. For the Israelites to be saved, the Egyptian firstborn had to die. For us to be saved, God's firstborn, Jesus, died. Fourthly, God views us as his firstborn as well. And we became his firstborn because of the death of his genuine firstborn. Fifth, just as there was darkness for 3 days in Exodus before the final plague of death, so too it was dark for 3 hours before Jesus, the firstborn, died. The death of God's firstborn was a judgment against Satan, which is parallel with the Egyptians' firstborn death being a judgment against Pharaoh. The Lord's Supper is our new Passover meal, so that when our children ask, hey, what are we doing? We can tell them, because not because God saved us from Egypt, but because God saved us from sin. Eighth, everyone can partake of the Lord's Supper, provided they're circumcised with the circumcision made without hands in baptism. Yeah, all are welcome to God's salvation and his feast, but you have to meet conditions, right? Ninth, there can't be any leaven in the church or in our hearts. Leaven becomes synonymous with evil and evil influence in the New Testament. And Christianity is really a perpetual feast of unleavened bread. Paul says, let's partake of this feast, you know, without any malice, and he wasn't talking about a particular feast day. He was just saying this worship that we have, this blessing of being God's people as New Testament Christians really is just kind of a perpetual feast of celebrating God. So I'm so sorry I rushed through that. I mistimed that. I should have gone faster earlier. But I hope you see the power of God, the wisdom of God, to foresee all of this 1,500 years before Christ and the church ever came. Nothing God does is random. It's all part of his beautiful plan to bring us to him. Yeah, the whole thing. So thank you all very much. And the assignment for next time is 31, the second part of page 31. to the first part of 36 in the Waldron book. Thank you all so much for your comments and thoughts.